Hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. And today is Wednesday, November 21st, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests today are novelists Jonathan Lethem and Deborah Gall. First up is Jonathan Lethem. He's the New York Times bestselling author of 10 novels, including The Fortress of Solitude and Motherless Brooklyn. He's winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, currently teaches creative writing at Pomona College in California, and he's here today to primarily talk about The Feral Detective, published by Echo. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey. Hi there. How are you?
Good. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. You know, let's begin by talking about The Feral Detective and how the novel came about.
Well, yeah, there's a kind of a long backstory on this book. First of all, I moved from New York City to the desert. So here I am, you know, in the kind of what they call the Inland Empire. And I'm bringing all my preconceptions from the East with me. So I think, I've moved to L.A., but I haven't really moved to L.A. I mean, you know, I can get there. I can drive west and, you know, engage with all that classic L.A. imagery, the Pacific Ocean, the big blue horizon, and the Hollywood sign, and the film industry. And that's interesting, but I'm really quite far away from it. But what I am, when I turn around and face the other way, is on the kind of the doorstep of the desert. I can kind of be in Joshua Tree, like falling out of bed. And this landscape becomes increasingly just intriguing to me. There's a lot about it that I respond to automatically. It's just, you know, kind of sublime and weird. And, you know, you feel human life feels different in that reduced scale of the desert. You know, where you're just a speck on a planet. people aren't bunched up together. And there was a lot about it that was really opaque and, you know, and provocative. Like, just the way people go out there to do things and what they're out there to do and the kind of off-the-grid, existence that people are seeking. It's both like a right and a left fantasy at the same time. You can be a libertarian and, you know, be into off-road vehicles and blowing things up, or you can be very, very anarchist, artsy, and, you know, eat cactus to survive and build sculptures, and you can do things that are sort of in between, and you can't tell what they are. And I just thought, this is really cool, and it's, like, under-described by fiction, and I started to want to write about it. Mm. And at the same time, I was reconnecting with a mode that had been very important to me in the past with my first novel, Gun with Occasional Music, and with Motherless Brooklyn, which is a book that is often the one that people most remember me for, which they're both first-person hard-boiled detective-style narration. And it's a really sturdy, interesting mode that obviously comes in many ways from California. It comes from Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, and then is extended by people like Ross McDonald. And so I was living here, and I started to reread these books that were set in this area and see them less metaphorically and more as a real description of this terrain. And I thought, oh, maybe I can reconnect with this.
Well, you know, I love the setting. I do love the setting so much. And it's interesting you writing about the desert coming from New York. Could it have taken place anywhere else, do you think, other than the desert, primarily the desert?
This story is really, I think it really is, the landscape's integral. But it's also a story about, utopia. It's about the weird American fantasy that we persist in, that, you know, it helps create this part of the country, especially the western edge, and that is that, you know, you can kind of head out into open space and set up a new world of some kind and abandon your baggage or the old hierarchies or the old problems. And of course, what you do is you drag your old hierarchies and problems and, you know, all the old systems come into that open space with you. And anyway, it rarely was purely open space. There usually were people that you had to kill or civilizations you had to dismantle to take over the area in question. So there is immediately incurs this legacy of, genocide at worst, and certainly conflict of some kind. And so it's, it's like a very qualified fantasy, but it still is it being enacted at some psychic level, I think. It, even as we've run into the edge, we hit the Pacific Ocean, we built places like the one I live in, the suburban sprawl of, Claremont and its surroundings, or the one you're in Irvine. So it would seem like, okay, well, let's take a look at this. What have we done? But I think if you go back east just a degree, there's still a Western frontier, lingering. This kind of idea that you can kind of go out and, this is, people recognize this in sort of phantasmagorical enactments that we do, like the Burning Man Festival.
Mm-hmm.
This is really still another idea where, the American notion of, like, let's build a city in the desert. Let's see what we can do here. That's still being played out. So that's what the characters in my story, not Phoebe, the narrator, who comes from New York and is completely bewildered and in many ways outraged by what she finds, but a lot of the other characters come out of this really sort of, scuffling but interesting fantasy of going into the desert and, getting off the grid. It was just something I think, people are entertaining these days.
Yeah, especially these days, huh? And Phoebe, she's such an interesting protagonist because she has left New York to find her friend's daughter, and she is also kind of freaked out. It's the Trump era is very much woven throughout the narrative and is about to drive Phoebe insane, or maybe it already has. Talk about coming up with Phoebe.
Well, so I was working my way towards this proposed novel, a hard-boiled detective story set in this desert landscape, and I had the idea of the feral detective, the guy himself who would be sort of like raised partly, by animals or in the wild, and then would set up shop as some sort of specialist in handling missing persons cases, people who went off the grid. And I wanted a proxy for the reader and for myself, because I'm from the East, and I still find a lot of this territory really completely unsettling. And so I knew I wanted it to be a New Yorker, and I was also bored with writing about men, which I'd been doing a lot of. Every now and then I feel like I need a woman protagonist, and I'd done this a couple of times before in a book called Girl in Landscape. It's a teenage girl, and in a book called You Don't Love Me Yet, it's a late 20s bass player in a rock band in Silver Lake. And I thought, okay, let's do this again, and I'm going to give the first person hard-boiled narration to the woman instead of to the detective, and see what that does to the book. So I was all set to go, and then thinking it was a very nice project for me to write in the first couple of years of the Hillary Clinton administration. And then November 2016 came along, and I was just as disarranged as anybody. I mean, I looked at my own daily, work. I looked at what was on my desk, which was this plan for this novel, and it looked kind of pointless. The morning after, and I wasn't sure what to do for a little while, and then I came to this feeling that it would be interesting, and maybe it would get me back on my feet, get the book on its feet, or get me back on the horse. I'm not sure what the right description is. If I incorporated these feelings, so I thought, well, let's set it right now. And if Phoebe's a runaway from New York who's come out to the desert, now she has a reason, because the election has made her go half mm-hmm, insane.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, so I gave her a job right in the heart of the, you would call it, I guess, the liberal intelligentsia, the bubble. She works for the op-ed page of the New York Times and quits that job because she's outraged at the complicity of people like her, and especially the people she works for immediately, in not understanding that this world was already, in a way, gone, that the world that they fantasized about living in was halfway destroyed. And then, the election seems in some ways to rip the lid off that and make it obvious. And so she becomes disaffected from her world and runs into this this chase scene in the desert, this missing persons hunt, partly to help her friend find her missing daughter, but also to get away. She herself is playing out a kind of going off the grid fantasy.
You know, you're famous for mixing genres, it seems, and The Feral Detective, to me, was a literary novel, and it was also a hard-boiled detective novel, as you said. It's kind of one of my favorite kind of mixes, actually. Is that something you think about going in, or are you seeing where the story leads and just sort of following it, following style, following tone?
Well, it's very different with different projects. I mean, you know, at the beginning of my career, when this reputation that you're describing sort of set up, you know, it's unmistakable with my first couple of books that I was thinking, what would happen if I smashed the hard-boiled detective voice together with a kind of a dystopian future? Or with The Girl in Landscape, was very self-consciously an attempt to mix the coming-of-age novel, the literary novel, and the Western. You know, I was looking at a lot of John Ford movies and thinking about Monument Valley and The Searchers and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and I wanted to write about a character who was a lot like John Wayne in those movies, the sort of problematic anti-hero. And so, yes, sometimes I've been like really a deliberate genre collider, and in a way, The Feral Detective, you'd have to say, is a recaptures that intentionality, because you have to be foolish to not notice that you're picking up the hard-boiled voice and that you're having a female client walk into a male detective's office and ask him to help her find a missing teenager. That's an archetypal scene from the hard-boiled detective genre. So I was using it very self-consciously. In other books, at other times, I've felt my way in more, as you suggest. I know that the echoes of all my genre reading and my devotion to it, my love of genre, I guess is the simplest thing to call it, that those echoes do get into everything I write. But at other times, the books don't have such pronounced formats, let's say. This one does.
Love to hear you read. Could you read a little bit?
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, let me do just a bit of that opening when, as I say, Phoebe walks in. This is chapter 3, very very early in the book, and she's going to lay eyes on the feral detective for the first time. A voice behind the brass number 8 called, "It's open." I pushed in. The usual law of glaring sunlight applied, so I was blinded in the gloom. There wasn't a foyer or a waiting area, let alone a secretary screening his appointments. I lurched into the so-called suite, a large, cluttered, murky space that grew darker when the voice said, "Close the door," and I obeyed. In the instant I'd had to discern outlines, I made out the boat-sized desk, the figure behind it, the shapes along the walls, all inanimate. No other bodies waiting in ambush, I felt reasonably sure. Phoebe Siegler? The only lamp in the room sat on the desk. All I saw was jeans and boots. The lamp had for company only a landline, a heavy black office phone, no computer. "Sorry I'm late," I said, just to say something. He dropped his feet from the desk and rolled forward in his chair, and my eyes adjusted first to find his worn red leather jacket, cut and detailed like a cowboy shirt, with white leather-trimmed vest pockets and cuffs. The leather was so stiff and dry, it was as if a cowboy shirt had been cast in bronze, then spray-painted. Above, his big head came into the light. His eyes were brown under bushy, devilishly arched brows. His hair streamed back from his wide forehead, and his sideburns were wide and beardy enough to seem to stream from his cheeks, too, like his whole face had been pushed through a gap in a web of hair, I thought absurdly. He resembled one of those pottery leaf faces you find hanging on the sheds of wannabe English gardens. Somehow, despite or because of all of this, I registered him as attractive, with an undertow of disgust. The disgust was perhaps at myself for noticing. A minor nagging mystery for me had always been, what did Merrill see in Clint anyhow? I think I caught that movie on cable when I was 11 or 12, and I'd found him only baffling and weird. So maybe that was the mystery I'd come all this way to solve. Realizing I find someone attractive is often like this for me, a catching up of the brain to something as remote as if on some faraway planet. I guess I could cross it off my bucket list. I'd now felt a jerk on my chain for a 50-ish, cowboyish fellow. Go figure. So that's what
great.
It's like for her to
set
eyes on.
Where did Heist, the feral detective, come from?
Well, you know, it's really an archetype. Again, you know, I'm using very familiar materials in a different way. I was interested in the idea of the feral character before I knew the word. I was interested in Tarzan, you know. Mm-hmm. I was interested in Mowgli from The Jungle Book. And later on, I started to learn about the idea of the wild child and see it in a more complicated, less superheroic light. You know, I became fascinated by Caspar Hauser by watching a Werner Herzog film about Caspar Hauser. And there's also a very beautiful François Truffaut film called The Wild Child about a real case in France where a boy came out of the woods and
yes.
was without language. And, you know, and then, of course, you begin to learn even more sordid and uncomfortable stories about what tends to be called the feral child in contemporary, you know, true crime scenarios, which is always very tragic and disastrous, because it isn't about children raised in the wild or by wolves. It's about children locked in closets or somehow kept in basements and denied sociality or language, and it's a horrible result. It's very hard to reconstruct those things after the formative years have passed. And somewhere in the mixture between this very heart-rending image of, you know, these newspaper stories about children denied the normal experience of socialization and the fantasy of the Tarzan or Mowgli figure, I was resonating, you know, and if often for me that's something that I'm just interested in, and I don't know why, but I begin to develop an appetite to learn more, and I was sort of in a, you know, absent-minded way, kind of studying the image of the feral child, both in literature and in real fact or circumstance. So it stuck up on me for years and years as something I wanted to cast in a direct way in my fiction.
Mm. Yeah, what a great character. He's so strange and so compelling, and I can see why she likes him. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Jonathan Lethem, and his new book is The Feral Detective, published by Echo. So you've been teaching at Pomona for something like 9 years?
Yes, I'm in my 9th year doing this. That's right.
How does teaching influence your own writing?
Oh, in lots of ways. I mean, accidental and deliberate ones. The simplest thing to say is, of course, it supports it. You know, I've always... like most authors, sometimes people are surprised to hear this, you usually have to go on doing some other kinds of things. And for a long time for me, the other things were journalism or lots of speaking gigs or kind of guest teaching gigs where you drop in, parachute in as a, what they call, you know, like a visiting writer or a distinguished visitor, although actually the distinguished visitor is mostly distinguished by his lack of health insurance. So I learned to like teaching, doing it sporadically first, mostly on the East Coast in MFA programs at various places. I would come in for a semester here or there. And I wasn't trained as an academic. I actually dropped out of college. So this was a kind of responsiveness that snuck up on me. I didn't know that I would like to be in that atmosphere so much. But you quickly understand that, you know, the students who are drawn to study creative writing are very compelling, tender souls who are trying something that you identify with, and it's something you love, it's something you love to talk about, and that you do have things to offer them. You know, you teaching is a way to learn what you know, but that you didn't realize you know, that you just, you know, by practicing over the years writing novels, it's a very esoteric practice. It's very hard to quantify it or make general rules about it. But you do learn some things, and then you find out what those things are by trying to impart them to other humans. And that's, you know, a pretty special zone to be in. So I'm always really moved by it, and I steal energy from younger people, like a person taking a picture and stealing the soul of the person in the frame, and I let them help me think about things that I'm thinking about. I actually, one of the ways I kind of got closer to the subject of the feral detective was I taught a course called Animals in Literature, and we talked a lot about the human-animal interface in stories, and you know what it does to literature, what it does to novels or stories when you put non-human characters into the frame. And there's a lot of examples of that that I like very much. You know, from things like Kafka, where the character is a dog or a mole or a cockroach, or you know, or stories like Jack London, where you know the human animal partnership becomes becomes a kind of matter of life and death, and a Virginia Woolf novel like Flush, where she narrates it from the point of view of a dog. And so this was a way for me to sneak up on this material and, you know, think about ferality. But also, there are a lot of animal characters creeping around the edges of this book. There are dogs who are in lots of scenes, you know, and I wanted to figure out how I wanted to do that.
Yeah, I love the dog characters, actually. I think Jesse is one of the main ones. And
thank you.
What a great character.
Thank you.
You know, we are amazingly at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice or last words for the novelists who may be working their way through a novel.
And... for your audience, your large audience of aspiring novelists. Well, I have like two baseline pieces of advice I give when I'm, you know, shooting blind or just have only a second. And one is the obvious, just keep at it. Always be writing or trying to write or taking notes or thinking about your writing. The regularity, the everydayness, making it a habit, making it a, you know, an ordinary practice and part of your life is essential. The other thing I say to apprentice writers is don't forget to be playful at the outset. You know, try lots of different things. Surprise yourself. Don't just lock down into one conception of what kind of writer you're meant to be and then bear down as intensely as you can on that. You might not be exactly the writer you were envisioning. That I certainly didn't turn out to be completely the writer that I first forecast myself to be. It's really good to just stay kind of, you know, polymorphous perverse as long as you can, dabbling, playing, challenging yourself to do unexpected things, and experiencing the discoveries that come with it.
So what did you envision yourself to be? What sort of writer were you thinking you were?
Well, you know, I mean, I think in some kind of peculiar way, I thought I would be a much more conceptual and hard-edged kind of colder writer, not in the negative sense, but where everything would be so strongly driven by a kind of philosophical or conceptual premise, and that I wouldn't be as interested in emotion and language and humor as I have turned out to be. I wanted to be very intense and deep in a kind of modernist way, and you know, I mean, I hope my books provide elements of all of those things, but I know that I also have ended up really being into shaggy dog stories and also love stories, both of which I think describe the feral detective in a certain way.
Yeah, you know, I love the love story running through this book, and I wanted to talk to you a bit about that too. And we're out of time. Maybe when it's out in paperback, we can talk again.
That'd be great. We'll plan another conversation.
Thank you,
Jonathan, for having me on.
You're so welcome.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was Jonathan Leatham. His book is The Feral Detective, and published by Echo. We're going to take a short break. When we're back, we will have Deborah Gall with us, so stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. Oh, yes.
such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you,
just a thought,
my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are still broadcasting from UC Irvine and on KUCI.org, and I remain Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My first guest was Jonathan Lethem, and in a second I'll bring on Debbie Gall. But I want to say that this show and all the others are podcasts, so if you go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing when it's podcast, you will get it in your podcast inbox. And I think today you are either listening on the computer or not listening at all, because we're having some signal problems. So hopefully you're with us and you can hear the rest if you go back to the podcast later and re-listen. I have my good friend Debbie Gall in the studio with me, and I'm so happy to have her. I want to introduce her with this. She abandoned a love of theater to take over the family flooring business and ended up running a wholly owned subsidiary for DuPont. After leaving DuPont, she coached entrepreneurs and corporate execs, and in addition to creating and guiding leadership seminars for women. When she left that life, she turned to writing. She's a repeat recipient of the San Diego State University Writers Conference Editor's Choice Award, and I'm so pleased to have her in the studio to talk about The Dream Stitcher. Hello there.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me. Really, this is fun.
Of course. It's great to have you. So let's begin as we always do. Talk about where The Dream Stitcher came from.
So in the Dream Stitcher, much of the story revolves around a tapestry. It is a recreation of the Bayeux tapestry that hangs in France. It is a 6 foot wide by 14 foot long replica of that tapestry of excerpts. And in real life, my mother spent 8 years of her life making a 6 foot wide by 14 foot long replica of excerpts of the Bayeux. It was a project she started when I was in high school. She was building a home that would have a two-story vaulted living room, and she and my father wanted a tapestry to hang over the fireplace, so they went to New York to look at tapestries. This was in 1964, and she found one she loved for $25,000. And, that was a lot of money in 1964. My father said, "Are you insane?" She said, "Well, if you won't buy me the tapestry I want, I'll make one myself." So being the indomitable woman that she was, she started to research tapestries. She fell in love, for some crazy reason, with the Bayeux tapestry. And she flew to France to see it in person. She researched it using a curator in London who was an expert in the Bayeux. They picked out the exact colors of yarns. She actually dyed yarn in teacups, 3-minute tea-stained yarn, 4-minute, 5-minute, all the way up to 10-minute tea-stained yarn, so she could make this work look authentic and antique. So she made this, took her 8 years, in almost monastic silence. And I never asked her why she picked that subject matter. I knew she needed something that was meaty and large to fill that kind of space, but why that? So as my mother aged and I got more reflective about life, I wanted to know what really had motivated her to do this. What would make somebody do that? Well, by that time, my mother had Alzheimer's and she couldn't answer my questions. So I started to have this, my own inner dialogue. What was it that would motivate someone to do that? Would you sew this for 8 years because your life depended on it? Did the life of your family depend on it, or a country? Or were you reincarnated? All of these things became the story of the Dream Stitcher, and that was the that's what led me to write this. I have to also mention, I forgot to say, that my mother also was looking for a place to hang the tapestry. Before she went into an assisted living home, she needed a place to hang it. I had a two-story vaulted living room, so I wound up with the tapestry. And living with it in my home for 10 years, it kind of worked on me. And you can't live with something without it affecting the way you are and the way you think. And I think that experience very much led me to this writing.
So that was the tapestry that I've seen hanging
yes,
in your house.
Yes, you got to see that tapestry.
Interesting.
Yeah, wow. I promised my husband I would take it down when I finished the first draft of the Dream Stitcher, mm-hmm. which was probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And it's now in Springfield, Illinois, with my nephew and, mm-hmm. and niece. So the tapestry is still in the family, but we don't have it in the house anymore.
Yeah, interesting. It was museum quality.
It was. My mother, it actually was shown in a museum. St. Louis University had a showing and showcased the tapestry, and she was thrilled by it. And she got many letters from needle artists in the country telling her how fabulous it was, and she got to have her moment. So that was a fun journey for her.
So talk about the structure of the Dream Stitcher, because you have, I think you basically have three points of view. I mean, you have Queen Matilda, right, which is more of a magical realism element.
Correct.
And then you have Maud's storyline, and then you have Goldie's storyline.
Correct,
that,
yeah.
sort of changes as time goes on.
Yeah.
Talk about
that. Yeah, so I wanted to write the story about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, but I also wanted to talk about what was going on today. And it actually, the story takes place in 2008, right during the mortgage meltdown. And as I was researching World War II and all of the elements that led to that war, I realized that in 2008, when the mortgage meltdown happened, and in some ways it was kind of the death of the American dream, the loss of homes. I've read many articles that talk about how that year kind of led to the rise of nationalism, and how the rise of nationalism, of course, we know, led to World War II. And so I was interested in playing with those two time frames. And that's why I have characters in 2008 where Maud is dealing with the loss of her home, which, of course, she thinks to her is the worst thing that could happen. And, of course, it's not. There are worse things that can happen, which is exemplified by Golda's life living in 1940. So that was the genesis of the thoughts around those two time frames and why they connect.
Did you always know it was going to be multiple point of view?
You know, I didn't. It's weird. When I started writing the story, I had three seeds, and I don't know where the three seeds necessarily came from. I wanted to write about the dynamics that were going on in the mortgage meltdown. I wanted to write about the Warsaw Ghetto. I wanted to write about the Bayeux Tapestry. And for some reason, those three seeds, I couldn't get them out of my head. And I tried to write something that wasn't so complicated. You know, people have said to me, how could you write this crazy story, and how could you fit this all in one book? And it did work out. It happened. But during the writing of it, it was like, you know, they talk about writing going through the fog, and that's how it felt. Writing about these three subjects and tying them together in a tight story was very challenging. But I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the elements. And once they were intertwined, there was no way I could possibly separate them.
Goldie and Lev's story is quite moving. What inspired that relationship?
So I was interested in also exploring the idea that, let me reframe. Growing up, my father, he had left Russia. He emigrated from Russia when he was 5 years old during a pogrom. And at the time, the borders between Russia and Poland would change all the time. So nobody, you know, some years were Polish, some years were Russian. So that culture was very similar. And my father would talk about the anti-Semitism in Poland. And growing up, I was very aware of that. And I was interested to explore a relationship with someone in Poland who would not be anti-Semitic, who would be very sympathetic to the Jewish cause, because I knew that it just didn't make sense. Not everybody in Poland obviously was anti-Semitic. So that's what I wanted to explore, and that was Lev. Lev was someone who was half Polish, he was half Jewish, or half Aryan, I should say, half Jewish, and he was very sympathetic. And of course, he had friends from the Polish liberation that were helping. So that, I wanted a love story between someone who was Polish and someone who was Jewish. And that became the story of Lev and Golda.
Let's hear you read.
Okay.
And if you just tuned in, I'm with Debbie Gall. Her book is The Dream Stitcher.
Okay. So I'm going to read a few pages. This is the beginning of meeting Golda, and Golda and her father are on a shopping trip to get her a birthday present. She's been talking nonstop about buying a doll because she wants a doll that would look like her imaginary friend, Queen Matilda. We're in the middle of the scene. Spring sunshine glinted off the plate glass windows of Kaminsky Fine Fabrics, causing Golda to rub her eyes and squint so she could read the sign. Bolts of cloth and skeins of yard crowded the storefront. Blue chintz, rose chiffon, and mint-crushed velvet. Other textiles she couldn't name. Threads the color of daybreak and sunset and every hour in between. Papa tugged her. Let's go. Golda released his hand and pressed her palms flat against the window, mesmerized, trying to assign obscure names to the rainbows of yarn. Eggplant, emerald, magenta, crimson. Papa pulled her back. You'll smudge the glass. She ignored him, transfixed to the merchandise and the conversation forming in her head. Is it okay, Matilda? Golda asked. Would you mind terribly? The queen answered, Yes, yes, it's exactly the thing to do. I demand it. Papa, must I buy a doll? Golda asked her father. What? Can we go inside, please? She forced herself to pull away from the resplendent display and gaze up at him. His chestnut eyes said she could have the moon if only he could afford it. "Well, it's your special day. I have to give you what you want. It's a rule, and a rule is a rule." He shrugged and pushed open the door. The doorbell tinkled. Color rushed toward Golda, beckoning her forward. She released her own will to this force much larger than herself. She itched to stroke every bolt of fabric and skein of yarn. Her hands longed to skim the surface of wool bundles, far softer than a porcelain-faced doll could ever be. But the feeling of connection to this new source left her motionless. She stood in reverence, as though praying in synagogue. Something deep within her she couldn't name spoke to the thread. "We can make something important," Queen Matilda whispered. "Heed our calling." The thread said, "Touch." Golda glided by the tables piled high with treasure. Images bounced in her head. A cat, a dog, a horse, a queen with blonde hair and blue eyes. A cow, an elk, a flower. Her fingers grazed the wool, igniting a hunger to make pictures with thread. She could sew stories, yarns. "I'll help you," the queen said. The shopkeeper, a flaxen-haired gentleman about Papa's age, approached them. "If you're just looking, you mustn't touch," he said indifferently. He had a kind expression, and something sad in his washed-out gray eyes. "It's my daughter Golda's birthday," Papa said. "Ah, do you sew, Golda?" he asked, studying her, and she suddenly felt small. She cast her eyes toward the door and shook her head. "Fabric is very expensive if you don't know what you're doing," the shopkeeper said. "I want to make pictures with thread," she said so softly she could barely hear her own words. "Then you'll need a fine embroidery needle, very expensive." He reached into the case and flourished a large-eyed silver needle before her. "How does this feel in your hand?" Golda gripped the needle with her thumb and index finger, and he relinquished it to her care. The tiny saber cooled the tips of her fingers, then warmed as she imagined how to guide it up, through, down, and up again. Her hand moved of its own accord and pantomimed the motion. "You know what to do," the shopkeeper said. "I'll tell you what, Golda. Since it's your birthday, I'll give you this needle, a spool of thread, and a piece of fabric." We can stop there.
Oh, thank you so much. That was Debbie Gall reading from The Dream Stitcher. So there's so much to talk about in like 10 minutes.
Well, I'll talk fast. Just fire away.
Well, you know, one thing is, you know, the different point of view characters have very different voices.
Yes.
And the whole style of the writing is different. And talk about going from one to another and
right.
back again.
So my background is that I'm an actor. That was really where I sowed my oats and what I longed to reconnect with. And my whole writing journey was always about trying to reconnect with that creativity and acting. And so when I would write these different scenes, be it in Golda's voice or Maud's voice, I was acting. Mm. I would be Maud, and I would just write down what Maud thought and her emotions, and I would be Golda, and I would play those roles. So the language of that time came about from just kind of those exercises and studying, of course, old films and reading books. You pick up that language, but it just was very natural to me to do that. And it was very natural for me to, of course, the modern language is no issue. So that's, you know, really how I did it. I just got into a very meditative state. I tried to be that young girl living in 1940 and write from her point of view, including the way she would talk. And I'm really glad people have told me that mm-hmm. they actually get a sense of the time without me having to say who's speaking or
right.
what year it is.
Right.
So.
No, they're very distinct. And that's something that's advised for writers often, especially lately, is to take an acting class so that you can really sort of get into the character in a different way instead of the character just living on the page, that you embody
right.
the character.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, that's why writing became so natural for me. I really never thought of myself early on as a writer. Mm. I was an actor. But I didn't feel like going to rehearsals every night for 8 weeks to do, you know, some community theater where I would leave my husband every night. I didn't want to do that at this stage in my life. So this became a way for me to fulfill that thrill and work those muscles without actually having to leave the house. And it's been just, you know, a marvelous journey from that standpoint. I've really enjoyed it.
There's some wonderful lines throughout this book, and I wrote one down. It's toward the end of the book where B says, I didn't know then that the worst harm you can... I didn't know then that the worst harm you can cause yourself is success at revenge. Yes. It carves a hole in your heart that never closes. Where'd that come from?
So, I'm really glad you pointed out that line, because I love that line, too.
That's a great
line. I really do. And I think that's been one of my lessons in life. You know, revenge is a terrible thing to carry. It really is. And I think I had some experiences in my life, not that I really felt revenge towards someone, but my experiences in business that made you so hard-boiled. And I can remember having some particular people that I thought, boy, if I could just get back at them, you know, I'll show them a thing or two. Because, you know, when you're in the business world, unfortunately, the saying hard work is exactly what happens. Work makes you hard. It's hard work. And I remember having those feelings and wanting to dispel of those feelings. And I think, you know, they say that when you write, you are all your characters, and B is a part of me. And she took revenge, and she suffers greatly from it. I guess that's where that came from.
Yeah, interesting. And the end, I mean, the end was interesting, and who showed up, and kind of the twist. But how much of that did you know going in? Did you plot this out? Did you know that?
You know, I didn't. I didn't plot it out, and I wish I could have. It would be so much easier. But I am one of those writers that just has to keep writing and find the story that way. I had no idea that the ending that showed up was going to show up until it became so clear to me, and I had to go back and rewrite very much of the beginning to put some seeds in place so that when the end happened, the reader wouldn't go, what?
Yeah.
What's that?
No, it
worked.
So
it's all there, yeah. Yeah, but I did have to go back because I truly didn't know, and I was as shocked as any reader. My character came to me in the middle of the night, and she said to me, you know, you have no idea what's going on in this story. And I said, okay, tell me. And I listened, and because of that, I went back, made changes, and rewrote
the story. So you have characters that talk to you.
They do.
How lucky.
Well,
I
cultivate it. It's a very strange process, but I do. I actively cultivate it by inviting them into my writing sessions. I meditate and invite them all in. And
so talk about that, because I know you do rituals. You've talked about rituals before. Like, you sit down to write, then what?
So before I sit down to write, I light candles. And I invite all the muses that are part of the story. So in this case, I had some freedom fighters, some Holocaust victims as well as survivors that would be part of my group. I had some Polish liberation fighters. I had people from that era that I invited in. And I would light candles and talk to them. And when I felt that I was in a meditative state, I would start to write. And they would tell me things. So, like, for instance, Lev showed up one day, and he was very upset that I had not written a motorcycle for him, because he said he had a motorcycle. So I had to plant a motorcycle. It was funny little things like that that would show up. But I just cultivated getting them to talk to me. And, of course, you know, it's all in my head, or however you want to view it. But it really worked, even in building details as well as building the plot of the story.
I love that. So then how did you keep it all straight? I mean, you know, it's one thing to have one point of view character and one main kind of story and go with that. But when you have a few of them going on, what's your office look like?
So people ask me that all the time, and I know it's really crazy. I worked... on one document, at one Word document on my computer. I would make notes, but I didn't have a chart. I didn't have, you know, a big piece of cardboard with mm-hmm. sticky notes all over it. It's the way my mind works. I've always been able to pick little bits and pieces of things and make sense out of it without having to kind of organize it in black and white before me. And that's what worked for this. It stays all in my head, and that works for me. I don't recommend that for other people necessarily, but that's how my mind works. And I have another full-length manuscript that jumps around in time, and I was able to keep track of it in my head as well. So it's kind of crowded in there, but my head somehow can work for a novel form.
But it works. We are at the end of our time.
That's a bummer. I have so
it's
much more to say.
I know. What is this? We should have done an hour. I'm saying that all the time. Maybe I have to go back to one-hour shows with one writer. But, talk about maybe in closing how you deal with hitting the wall. Like when you hit the wall and you don't know where to go, what happens? What do you do? Do you stay in your chair? Do you get up? Do you exercise? Do you have a cup of tea? How do you get through those blocks?
Yeah. So I recommend anybody get up out of the chair and move around. I do have very long sessions when I write. I'll write for, 4 to 5 hours at a crack and have to remind myself to get up. I really do get very lost in it. But when I do get stuck, and, again, I'll go back to my inviting my muses into the room and getting very meditative, I will actually just beg and plead and pray that they help me figure this out. I let them, I'm not alone in this. This is not just my journey. It's yours. If you want this story to happen, then you better help me. And I just beg until something shows up. And then, of course, I'll take a break and go grab a cup of tea. But I think, I highly recommend groveling to your characters. Groveling works, and they will definitely show up and do something.
Groveling. I like that. When you're having trouble,
grovel. Yeah, it works in all things in life. You can grovel in all kinds of situations.
Oh, Debbie, this is a wonderful book.
Thank you
for writing it and for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really fun. I've been an admirer of your show and of you, and you've been one of the mentors that has helped me. So thank you so much.
Thank you. We're at the end of today. I've been with Deborah Gall. Her book is The Dream Stitcher. You can find it online. You can find it here and there.
Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And that's it. So all of you writers out there, go to iTunes, subscribe to Writers on Writing so you can hear this show again from start to finish and all the other shows that are on the podcast. In the meantime, stay in the chair and remember to grovel. And have a great Thanksgiving and a great week.